Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
From NPR News in Mexico City, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Eder Peralta. Good morning. The U.S. continues attacks on alleged drug boats, but is killing survivors a war crime? Also, Netflix's huge new buy and what it might mean for movies. And in Australia, a great experiment, banning kids from social media, no TikTok or Instagram for anyone under 16. And the actor Wagner Moura on playing it cool while facing a death threat.
That's what happens in war zones as well. People try to carry on with their lives. That gives the character more complexity.
Also, all the words we couldn't pronounce in 2025. But first, the news. It's Saturday, December 6, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump's new national security strategy is critical of Europe in several ways, one of them being its support for Ukraine. Terry Schultz reports.
The strategy says Europe is in economic decline and faces impending civilizational erasure. It blames the European Union in part for undermining political liberty and sovereignty, including freedom of speech. It says within a few decades, certain NATO countries will become majority non-European due to excessive immigration. The German Marshall Fund's Ian Lesser says the document is unlikely to be widely appreciated, but
the hard right and those who share that view about migration and replacement theories and things of that nature, we'll find in this some common cause.
On X, former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt notes, Europe seems to be the only part of the world where the new security strategy sees any threat to democracy, which he calls bizarre. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Meanwhile, the war continues. Ukrainian officials say Russia launched missile and drone attacks against Ukraine overnight. The president said they were targeting mainly energy facilities. Qatar says negotiations over the war in Gaza are at a critical moment. Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani told the annual Doha Forum that mediators were working hard to push phase two of a U.S.-backed peace plan.
What we have just done is a pause. We cannot consider it yet a ceasefire. A ceasefire cannot be completed unless there is a full withdrawal of the Israeli forces, there is stability back in Gaza, people can go in and out, which is not the case. Right now, we are, as Qatar, Turkey, Egypt, together with the United States, we are getting together in order to force the way forward for the next phase. And this next phase is just also temporary.
The first phase began October 10th, which halted the fighting and allowed for the exchange of hostages. The Supreme Court is clearing the way for Texas to use the 2025 redistricting map for its midterm congressional elections. But it doesn't guarantee Republican control of the House next year, as President Trump sought by pressing for Texas to redistrict in the first place. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has more in the story.
Texas moved to redistrict its congressional map mid-decade, set off a nationwide arms race to redistrict by both parties. Travis Crum is a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
The signal that gets sent with this case is going to reverberate in the legal challenges to California, future legal challenges to other mid-decade redistricting maps that are being filed across the country.
In addition to California, Democrats in Virginia and Maryland are considering mid-decade redistricting to counter Texas. Republican states that have followed Texas' lead include Missouri and North Carolina. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
And you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Live from KQED News in San Francisco, I'm Dana Cronin. A federal judge in San Francisco is expected to issue a ruling soon after he heard California's legal challenge to the continued federalization of 300 state National Guard members yesterday. After the hearing, State Attorney General Rob Bonta said there are limits on the president's power to deploy troops.
And yet this president believes that if he's able to deploy the National Guard, he can then deploy the National Guard in whatever number to whatever place for any amount of time forevermore thereafter. And he simply cannot.
In court, U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer questioned the federal government's argument that protests in Los Angeles last summer rose to the level of a threat of rebellion, or that local law enforcement couldn't handle them. Bay Area soccer fans gathered at Chase Center in San Francisco yesterday to find out what teams will play each other in the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The U.S. will play in Group D with Paraguay and Australia, and a fourth team that will be determined by playoffs in March. Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara will host five of those games, which could also include teams from Algeria, Austria, Jordan, and Argentina. San Jose native and FIFA World Cup champion Brandi Chastain says holding the World Cup in the Bay Area could have a big local impact.
It will give opportunity. It will show soccer at the highest level. It will allow for one young kid, hopefully if not hundreds of thousands of them, to see themselves in the game.
Levi's Stadium will also host one other game later in the tournament. I'm Dana Cronin, KQED News.
Support for NPR comes from Legacy Box, committed to helping preserve moments that matter this holiday season by digitizing videos and photos and then storing them in the cloud so they can be gifted for generations to come. LegacyBox.com. This week at KQED.org, you'll meet two Bay Area teens who are mapping the movements of coyotes in Silicon Valley, plus how to understand your options for paying back student loans. Find that at KQED.org. A chilly start to the morning and some patchy dense fog in some spots too. Partly cloudy with that patchy dense fog in the morning, then becoming sunny today. Dry, highs the 50s to mid-60s. Sacramento mostly cloudy in the morning, becoming partly cloudy. Widespread fog, locally dense in the morning. Patchy fog early in the afternoon, highs 52 to 58.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ader Peralta, filling in for Scott Simon. Big news out of Hollywood yesterday. Netflix is set to buy the storied Warner Brothers Studios in a deal worth almost $83 billion. And if that goes through, the deal could change what movies are shown in cinemas. NPR culture correspondent Mandalit Verbarco joins us from Los Angeles to tell us more. Buenos dias, Mandalit.
Buenos dias.
So tell us, which companies did Netflix have to beat for its winning bid for Warner Brothers Discovery?
Yeah, so Netflix beat out its deep-pocketed competitors, Paramount, Skydance, and Comcast, the cable company that also owns Universal Pictures. And Ader, Tuesday night, my editor and I were at the Netflix holiday party.
Lucky you.
We saw CEO, co-CEOs Ted Sarandos looking especially happy. And by Friday morning, he broke the news to investors.
I know some of you are surprised that we're making this acquisition, and I certainly understand why. Over the years, we have been known to be builders, not buyers. But this is a rare opportunity, and it's going to help us achieve our mission to entertain the world and to bring people together through great stories.
And, you know, Ted Sarandos said the merger made sense, that Netflix and Warner Brothers complement each other.
Okay, complement each other. What do you think he means by that?
Well, you know, if this deal is finalized and approved, Netflix is getting a lot. Basically, the crown jewels of a century-old Hollywood studio and its intellectual properties. I mean, Warner Brothers is known for its classic films like Casablanca, its Looney Tunes cartoons, the Harry Potter films, and even its TV shows like Game of Thrones. And all of that will belong to Netflix now, along with a library that includes The Wizard of Oz and DC Comics with superheroes Batman and Superman. But one note here is that some of Warner Brothers' cable channels like CNN are not part of this deal.
I imagine that Netflix is feeling pretty great at the moment. But what about everyone else in the industry? How are they feeling?
Well, theater owners are very worried about this mega deal. In fact, Cinema United, the trade organization representing thousands of theaters around the world, it says it opposes the deal. And they say that 25% of the annual domestic box office could disappear if Warner Brothers movies go straight to the streaming platform. That's been Netflix's business model. James Cameron, the director, he's always urging people to watch movies in the theaters. Well, last week before the deal was made, he speculated about what would happen. Here he is on the podcast, The Town.
Netflix would be a disaster. You Sorry, think so? Ted, but yeah. Geez, Sarandos has gone on record saying theatrical films are dead.
Outmoded, yeah.
No, theatrical is dead, quote unquote. Theatrical is dead.
So Ted Sarandos says he'll continue to open movies in theaters, but for how long before they're streamed on Netflix? A lot of people are skeptical.
Are Hollywood's major unions among those skeptics?
Yes. The Producers Guild, the Actors Union, they say they're very concerned, and the Writers Guild wants the merger blocked. They warn in a statement that the deal will eliminate jobs, push down wages, and raise prices for consumers. The Directors Guild of America, that's headed by filmmaker Christopher Nolan, they say it will be meeting with Netflix to understand more of what all of this means. Actress Jane Fonda calls this a catastrophic business deal that could destroy Hollywood and the entire entertainment industry. She spoke on behalf of the Committee for the First Amendment, which her father, Henry Fonda, helped create during the McCarthy era. And we should note that the Actors Union SAG-AFTRA also represents many of us at NPR.
So this is a huge business deal. Will regulators okay it?
We'll have to see, but there is bipartisan concern about the deal. Utah Senator Mike Lee, he tweeted that there's sure to be an antitrust hearing. Another Republican, Kansas Senator Roger Marshall, he suggests the deal could hurt consumers and even Western society. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, tweeted that the Netflix deal looks like an anti-monopoly nightmare. She said it'll create a massive media giant that would force consumers into higher prices and fewer choices. California Congressman Ro Khanna, a member of the Progressive Caucus, he told NPR the deal should be scrutinized by regulators.
These kind of mergers are anti-worker, they're anti-writer, they're anti-consumer, they're for corporate billionaires. And it's really a question of whose side the Trump administration is going to be on, the side of workers or the side of big corporations.
You know, we reached out to the White House for comment and haven't heard back yet. But Ted Sarandos told investors and reporters that he's confident of the regulatory process, and he says Netflix is going full steam ahead. And if the deal is approved by investors and regulators, Netflix, Warner Brothers, or whatever they'll call it, could be in business later next year.
That's NPR's culture correspondent, Mandalit Del Barco. Thank you for your reporting, Mandalit.
Thank you.
The U.S.'s deadly attacks on boats came into sharp focus this week after a group of bipartisan lawmakers raised the question of whether one of those strikes constituted a war crime. This came after the Washington Post reported that on September 2nd, the U.S. conducted two strikes on a boat the U.S. alleges was ferrying drugs, with the second strike intended to kill survivors. That strike was only one of the 23 the Pentagon has publicly acknowledged. By their count, at least 87 have been killed in the Caribbean Sea and Pacific Ocean since September, including another strike on Thursday that killed four. Luis Moreno Ocampo was the first prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, and he joins us now. Luis, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
So Luis, is targeting these boats with deliberate lethality a war crime?
Absolutely, yes, that's consensus in the U.S., but this is a marginal problem. It's a marginal violence. The biggest problem is the entire operation.
And what do you mean by that? The entire operation is based on a fallacy, you think, or what?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
The idea, during war, you can kill individuals. Law accept that. What happened here is President Trump's instruction is to expand the concept of war and decided that the U.S. is in a war, it's an armed conflict with drug dealers. And that is wrong. Many experts in the U.S. say that drug dealers are criminals, but they are not conducting hostilities against the U.S. So you cannot expand the concept of war to kill them with no trial. They should be prosecuted, yes. They should be arrested, yes. But they cannot be killed with no trial. That's the biggest problem.
Okay, so the Trump administration is trying to define this differently. It's part of what they call, quote, a war against narco-terrorists. What norms would govern such a conflict?
Well, the idea is that no country can use military to attack others just to defend themselves. So President Trump is pretending that the way to defend U.S. from drugs problem is killing people in the Caribbean. And it's expanding the idea of war, exporting war to South America, a region with no war for decades. That's a problem.
So people from Colombia have died, from Venezuela have died, we believe from Trinidad have died. Do those countries have recourses, seeing that their nationals are being targeted this way?
Depend where the shootings were. The easy answer is if the shootings happened in the Sea of Venezuela or Colombia or Trinidad, the national jurisdiction could investigate the crimes. If not, eventually, the International Criminal Court could do it because the three countries you mentioned are members. But for me, because there's such consensus in the U.S. about this wrong, probably what would happen is the next administration would consider seriously to open investigation on that, because in the U.S., the U.S. Army was trained that is not the way to behave. That's why President Trump is having problems to implement his instructions. He's removing the legal advice of the U.S. Again, drug dealers are criminals. They could be prosecuted.
So the U.S. is not a signatory to the Rome Statute, which was what established the International Criminal Court. Does that have an effect here? Would it have it in the future?
Well, the U.S. has relied in security on its own army. That's the way to do it. That's why the U.S. after 1945 decided to expand its military presence around the world. And that's why the U.S. don't like a court supervising what U.S. is doing. And that's why this is the type of discussion we have to have. How to fix the system, because the system is not working. The idea of the U.S. will provide security for the world is not working.
So right now, I mean, there are many reports and allegations of war crimes against both Russia and Ukraine in their war, against Israel in Lebanon and Gaza, against both the military and the paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan. Is international law playing any kind of deterrent right now?
It's a moment of change. War is still used to manage conflict. But now the International Court of Justice said that it's a risk of genocide in Gaza, and the International Criminal Court indicted President Putin for war crimes in Ukraine and indicted Prime Minister Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. So both at the same time are working. That's why it's complicated to understand. Okay, we have both systems in contradictions working at the same time. Nothing is perfect, but for instance, President Putin did not travel to South Africa. Prime Minister Netanyahu did not travel to Europe because they could be arrested there. So we need to take advantage of these opportunities to understand when to improve the global system to live together.
You say it's working, but it has failed to stop atrocities.
Imagine if the Supreme Court decisions are ignored by the president and the governors. So there's a problem. The court decision will be there, but governments are not implementing. That's happening in the world. In the world, there are 125 countries that will respect the International Criminal Court decisions, and many others not, including Russia, including the U.S., including Israel now. So it's a tension. It's a problem. The law has to be established, and it's just the beginning.
That's Luis Moreno Ocampo, the founding prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. Thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
Ahead on the Weekend Edition, you'll hear more about Australia's new ban on social media for kids under the age of 16. Also learn about 2025's most frequently mispronounced words. Ida Peralta will be speaking with a language expert from the app Babbel about that topic on KQED on Weekend Edition. I'm Michael State. Good morning. It's 8:18, and support for KQED comes from Oakland Ballet, presenting Graham Lustig's The Nutcracker, December 20th and 21st, a beloved holiday tradition and magical holiday experience in Oakland's iconic Paramount Theater. Tickets at oaklandballet.org. Support comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and their bedding at sleepworks.com.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. New Orleans is the latest target of the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants. Federal officials have not said exactly how many arrests were made this week. City leaders have sent a letter seeking information on those detained. Afghanistan and Pakistan reported today their forces exchanged gunfire along their border. Five people were killed. This comes nearly a week after a new round of peace talks ended in Saudi Arabia without a breakthrough. And police in South Africa are looking for those responsible for a mass shooting at an unlicensed bar near Pretoria today. They say at least 11 people were killed, including 3 children. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
When you're playing a video game and you get knocked out, most of the time, if you wait a moment, you get another character, another chance, and sometimes real life is the same way. On the next Snap Judgment, Respawn. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Snap Judgment on KQED this afternoon, beginning at 1. Support for NPR comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all on the web at theschmidt.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And support comes from the listeners like you of KQED News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ader Peralta. Next week, Australia is launching a massive nationwide experiment, kicking hundreds of thousands of kids and teens off social media. A new law bans children under 16 from sites including TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, and X. It's the first country in the world to implement such a law, and it's aimed at protecting young people. Many teens are not happy about it. TikToker Zoe Bender started a petition to lawmakers.
60, 70, 80-year-olds don't know how social media works. They don't know how the world works now. They should not be in Parliament making these decisions for us without getting our input.
There are still a lot of questions about how it will work and what impact it will have. And countries around the world are watching as they consider their own policies. Joining us now is Susan Sawyer. She's the chair of adolescent health at the University of Melbourne. Hey, Susan.
Good morning.
So first of all, I mean, how is this going to work? Is it enforceable?
The government has an expectation that the social media companies themselves will be requiring to take reasonable approaches to ensuring that under 16-year-olds from December the 10th aren't able to access the sites, but they are not mandating how that will happen. And I think that is one of the big questions.
And, I mean, there's a hefty penalty, right, if these companies don't comply.
There certainly is. So up to nearly $50 million Australian, that's about $35 million US for repeated transgressions. So, you know, there is a pretty hefty expectation that companies are going to do their bit. But I don't think anyone's expecting that this is going to be perfect from day zero by any means.
So let's get the broader view. What do we know about the harms social media can cause to young people?
I think there are a range of harms that we need to consider. You know, at its most basic, we know that highly addictive driven algorithms are encouraging kids to spend much more time online, that is time then not spent on other activities. And that includes physical activity and that includes sleep. Two key elements that are incredibly important to children's health and development more broadly. And then there are some more specific concerns about the potential impact on mental health, where the findings are a little bit more challenging. So we have lots of, if you like, correlational evidence from cross-sectional studies that would be suggesting that those young people who are spending more time on social media are the same group who have poorer mental health measures. But as you and your listeners would know, correlation is not the same as causation, and there are far fewer longitudinal studies that are really able to address this question of causation.
So that said, I mean, is this ban a good idea?
Look, I think it's interesting. I've been in two minds about this ban right from the start. You know, my initial concerns were very much about some of those really practical questions about implementation and really feeling that we need to be pushing tech companies to be doing their bit and trying to address this at source and really preventing the algorithms that are driving the addictive behaviours as the primary issue rather than necessarily putting in bans. However, it's very apparent that there is no appetite from governments, particularly your government, in relationship to holding tech companies to account for the material that is placed on their websites under their name. So whilst it's not my preferred approach, I do think that we have an expectation that there are going to be benefits from this, although I think probably the benefits are going to be a slower burn than many people might be expecting.
It's interesting because I think one of the thoughts in the United States, right, is that the control here should lie with the parents, right? I mean, I have an almost 13-year-old and she's been asking for a phone forever. She still doesn't have a phone. And it is a very difficult decision to make as a parent, right? But does it belong in the hands of the parent as opposed to in the hands of the government, which is, I think, the conversation that Americans would have, right?
Yeah. I've previously lived in the States when I was doing my medical training and was at Harvard, so I appreciate the very more individualistic context of the States in comparison to countries like Australia or Canada or European countries, for example. But I think this is failing to appreciate how addictive these algorithms are. And the sorts of additions like, you know, the notions of streaks where young people are then, you know, socially disadvantaged if they don't post something daily with friends, you know, these sorts of elements are just completely overwhelming young people's ability to make sensible decisions. And I don't think that's healthy. And expecting parents to toe the line with that is a recipe for disaster.
That's Susan Sawyer, Chair of Adolescent Health at the University of Melbourne. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's finally starting to snow in the West. A dry and warm fall has been a big concern for the country's $58 billion ski industry. So too are worries about a continued drop in international guests due to President Trump's tariffs and rhetoric about their countries. NPR's Kirk Ziegler reports from the resort town of Whitefish, Montana, which has seen a drop in Canadian visitors.
Ski patrollers getting ready for the season late last month at Whitefish Mountain Resort.
Thank goodness.
It's a typical safety training. They're practicing how to evacuate people off this lift in an emergency. But not much feels typical. First of all, no one's on skis.
Like, I'm looking at mostly grass all over the mountain. Not a lot of snow yet, at least at the base area. And it's just kind of adding to the economic anxiety.
Whitefish has since opened with some snow, but there's still anxiety, especially since no one knows how many Canadians will come to this resort about 60 miles south of the border. Whitefish has historically gotten a quarter of its business from up north.
We think of Canadians as our neighbors in British Columbia and Alberta. We're right here. We're a border state.
Zach Anderson runs Explore Whitefish, the local resort chamber, which has tracked about a 25% drop in Canadian visitors since President Trump slapped steep tariffs on Canada and said it should become the 51st state. Locals here are frustrated.
We don't have a say, so to speak, in, you know, national politics.
Canadian credit card spending is also down by 12% in Whitefish's upscale boutiques and restaurants and hotels. It's a big deal for a town with less than 10,000 people, and Anderson hopes Canadians will come back.
You know, for a little community like ours, the message is, we're here, we're open for business.
Well, this anxiety extends far beyond the American ski industry. The U.S. Travel Association is projecting there will be 5 million fewer international visitors this year.
I don't know if you call it a boycott.
Amir Alon runs the tourism research firm Longwoods International, which has been surveying Canadians monthly since last winter. Most are citing U.S. politics as the reason for canceling their trips, but also the weak Canadian dollar.
You had many Canadian travelers that were already on the fence about coming to the U.S. just from their own financial perspective. And then they're going to feel insulted or hurt. Then it makes it much easier for them to say, you know what? Not this year.
Small towns dependent on tourism are launching campaigns to entice Canadians back, including Kalispell, Montana, near Whitefish and Glacier National Park. Since it opened in 1912, the Kalispell Grand Hotel has been welcoming Canadian guests, says General Manager Mitchell Bump.
I mean, back in the day, I would say it was like kind of like the cowboys, you know, kind of like rough and rugged people coming, passing through.
65% of this county voted for President Trump last year, but they stand to take a big economic hit from cross-border politics. The local Chamber of Commerce has launched a new Welcome Back Canada initiative. Canadians get 20% off hotel rooms in the city.
I'm a hotel manager, so, like, not really a politician. You know, our job is to take care of guests and keep rooms filled year-round, especially in shoulder season. And that's really the lens I'm looking through.
Back up in Whitefish, Zach Anderson says the drop in Canadians for now has been buffered by a spike in domestic tourists and Montana's recent growth. But he says even these folks are tending to book last minute, and that's hard for businesses to plan for.
It's hard to know what's going to happen. The political winds seem to be shifting, you know, on an hourly basis.
Now, the biggest economic uncertainty for resorts like this is still snow. A big storm is dumping in Whitefish this weekend, but it's still way below average snowpack. Kirk Ziegler, NPR News, Whitefish, Montana.
Anyone who has been embarrassed about mispronouncing a word, or worse, a name, can rest assured that they're in good company. Newscasters, politicians, and other public figures tripped over plenty of words this year. In fact, there's a list thanks to the language teachers at Babbel and the people at the captioning group who add closed captions to screens. At the top of their list of the most mispronounced words is a very common painkiller.
I said, well, let's see how we say that. Acetaminophen.
Acetaminophen. President Trump isn't alone in stumbling over all those mushy vowels. Watching us all get tripped up this year is Esteban Touma, a linguist and cultural expert at Babbel. And just a note, Babbel is one of our sponsors. Welcome. And first, I mean, did I get your name right?
Well, that sounds like the perfect pronunciation in Spanish, but I'll let you know, my last name is from Palestine, so it's actually pronounced Touma.
Touma, Esteban Touma. Esteban, now it's your turn. Why don't you read the list for us?
Well, I will start by telling you, I'm not a native speaker of English myself. And so keep that in mind as I pronounce these words.
And a disclaimer from me, Esteban, because English is also my second language, so we're in the same boat.
You know the struggle. You know how it feels. So we have acetaminophen, Alec Murdoch, Denzel Washington, Louvre, Monjaro, the Swedish Hollywood actor Alexander Skarsgård, and of course, Zoran Mamdani.
And Zoran Mamdani's name tripped people up all year long as he ran for mayor of New York City. And sometimes he got testy about it.
The name is Mamdani, M-A-M-D-A-N-I. You should learn how to say it.
It's hard to imagine, right, that we're going to collectively get Mamdani right next year. I mean, people still mispronounce Vladimir Putin all the time.
All the time. It was one of our words in the past. I think what Zoran Mamdani said about his name kind of goes to the core of our list and the ideas of it, because he explained later in an interview that he doesn't take an issue with genuine mispronunciation, but repeated or deliberate mispronunciation crosses the line. And I think that kind of pinpoints of what we try to communicate, the notion that it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to say these words correctly, but trying to approach a correct pronunciation is already a step towards mutual understanding.
I mean, look, I think we here at NPR try to make room for our correspondents to say their own names correctly. And we get pushback from some listeners who dislike unfamiliar or foreign pronunciations. Does it matter anymore in a global world if people pronounce words or names differently?
First of all, the way you pronounce something is dependent on the dialect in which you speak and which part of the U.S. or the world you're from. We tell our learners that it's okay to get it wrong and make mistakes. But the important thing is that attempt, because that means that you are trying to understand other cultures, other words, other languages, and you're creating an approach to someone.
Esteban, why don't you leave us with some advice? What tricks or tips can you share for getting a hard word or a hard name right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I am a little bit biased, obviously, but I would say try to learn a new language. It will put you into the mindset of like, oh, there's this group of muscles that I've never moved in my throat in this way before, and try to approach it from that perspective, from a perspective of like, I know I'm not going to get it completely right, maybe, but here's my attempt. Let's go at it. Let's try to do it right.
Esteban Tuma is a linguist and cultural expert at Babbel. Esteban, thank you.
Eider, thank you so much.
One name we never mispronounce is BJ Lederman, who does our theme music. Morning light, I could barely sleep all night, had you on my mind. Eve Jarvis doesn't just write each song on his latest album. He also plays every instrument and does production. He won Best Canadian Album of the Year. We'll hear how he pulled it off later today on All Things Considered. Tune in by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Dana Cronin. California Senator Adam Schiff is among a growing group of Democrats to condemn Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Hegseth's use of the messaging app Signal, which led to a leak of highly classified information earlier this year, is under scrutiny, as is his role in the killing of two people who initially survived a U.S. military strike on a boat in the Caribbean. Here's Schiff, who spoke yesterday at an event in San Francisco.
His poor leadership at the Pentagon has resulted in now what may very well be a war crime. How is it possible the United States is killing two people clinging to a sinking vessel? That is strictly prohibited by the laws of war. He should be held accountable and he should be gone.
Lawmakers viewed a video of the boat strikes in a closed-door briefing last week with sharply divided reactions. Many are calling for the video's public release. Tosh Lapoy says his number one priority as UC Berkeley's new head football coach isn't on the field. Lapoy was appointed last week to replace Justin Wilcox, who was fired just a day after Cal's team lost against its rival, Stanford Cardinal. Lapoy, a Cal football alum and former defensive line coach, appeared at a press conference yesterday to share his vision for the team's future.
The first thing is talent acquisition. That is extremely, extremely important for us of how we recruit, the coaching staff that we bring in here, and then from there, developing and implementing our culture.
Lapoy said he plans to engage directly with potential recruits and highlight the value of a Berkeley degree and a robust football program. I'm Dana Cronin, KQED News.
Coming up on Weekend Edition, a look at sports, including the draw in the FIFA World Cup, and also more information about the deceased albino alligator Claude at the San Francisco, California Academy of Sciences. That is ahead, Weekend Edition from NPR News here on KQED. At 8:37, time for Listener Perspective. The listener is Kira Sisopan. And following back surgery, Kira shares about her journey of recovery and playing sports.
I remember walking to the cold, sterile hospital in October of my sophomore year. It was the day of my long-awaited back surgery to correct scoliosis. I slipped into a thin, itchy blue hospital gown and grip socks. It was 6 in the morning, and I hadn't had anything to eat or drink. I wasn't scared or nervous, just ready for it to be over. The process was long and tedious. Blood pressure checked, heart rate monitored, urine test completed. It took 4 painful tries to get the IV in, each one a sharp pinch. Before they put me under anesthesia, my mom asked the nurses to play Nora Jones, the same music she used to play to help me fall asleep as a kid. The surgery lasted 8 hours. When I woke up, needles, tubes, wires, and machines surrounded me. Despite the heavy medication, the pain was unbearable. I felt weak and tired, wondering what my friends were doing at school or if my dog missed me. Getting out of bed felt impossible. Each step was small but exhausting, yet I knew I had to push myself to recover. For 5 long months, my mom cared for me nonstop. I hated feeling like a burden, especially knowing she wasn't working. Watching her stress over money made me determined to heal faster. 3 years later, I pushed through the challenge of returning to sports, using physical therapy, clinics, and any resource I could find. Now, I'm a varsity starter on my high school volleyball team, and have played 2 seasons of competitive club volleyball, helping my team reach nationals 3 times. My back is no longer an issue, just a scar I often forget is there. Coming back to volleyball and to life after surgery was hard. But volleyball was my passion, the thing that kept me motivated through the pain. Looking back, every moment of that 5-month recovery was worth it. With a perspective, I'm Kira Sisipon.
Kira Sisipon is a senior in high school in California. She says she loves playing guitar, creating art, and, of course, playing volleyball. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and digital equity initiatives to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com.
On the next Radiolab...
Out of like 6,000 some species of mammals, they thought we were the only one.
The medical mystery...
We were just freaks.
...of menopause.
It was assumed that human females were the only species that went through it.
And then scientists learned about...
Granny. The matriarch of all matriarchs.
Hunter-in-chief.
The one in charge.
These females are the repository trees for ecological wisdom.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Radiolab begins this afternoon at 2 here on KQED News. Weekend edition time from NPR News is now 8:40.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukrainian officials say Russia launched hundreds of missiles and dozens of drones against Ukraine overnight. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said energy facilities were the main targets. Ukrainian negotiators are in Florida today. They're meeting for a third day of talks with Trump administration officials on finding a path to ending the war in Ukraine. And the black bear hunt is underway in Florida. For the first time in 10 years, hunters may legally hunt the black bear if they obtain one of the limited permits. Opponents of the hunt say they applied for permits with no intention of using them. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Partly to mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming sunny. Some patchy, possibly dense fog in the morning, too, with highs in the 50s to the mid-60s. Dry conditions anticipated at least the next couple of days, according to the Weather Service. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs, for chefs, and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And support comes from the listeners of KQED.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ader Peralta, and it's time for sports. World Cup matchups are set, so what's in store for the heavyweights and underdogs in the MLS Cup final? Sports reporter Michelle Steele joins me now. Hey there, Michelle.
Good morning, Ader.
Good morning. So yesterday, the Kennedy Center in D.C. hosted the draw for the largest World Cup ever. Michelle, let's look at how three favorites to win, Spain, France, and of course the defending champion, Argentina. How do their groups look like?
Yeah, let's start with Argentina. Mm-hmm. I would say Argentina and Leo Messi got what you can call, Ader, the champions welcome. The defending champs, they face Algeria, Austria, and first-timers Jordan. I think the only drama here is going to be whether Messi needs to play the full 90 minutes or not. Okay, moving on to the European champion, Spain, also drawing a friendly hand here in Group H. They got Cape Verde, Uruguay, and Saudi Arabia. Uruguay might be tricky, but the biggest opponent for Spain, in my opinion, might be their own jet lag. And then finally here, two-time winners, France. They got what's called the group of death, if you can, I see it that way at least. Kylian Mbappe, the France star, he's going to have to work for his dîner, as they say in France. They're going to have to survive Senegal and Norway, but if they do, they'll be battle-tested.
So, Michelle, as we mentioned earlier, it's the biggest World Cup ever with 48 teams qualifying, which means many more underdogs qualified. What are some of the notable ones and how did they fare in the draw?
Yeah. More teams, and that means a lot more underdogs. There's a few of them I want to focus on. Let's focus on Haiti first. Mm-hmm. Back for the first time in 50-plus years. Boy, are they in the deep end of the pool here with the group that they got. Scotland, Morocco, and, you know, just Brazil.
Brazil, oh.
Yeah, but we'll see if they can be kind of like a determined mosquito here at a picnic with some bigger boys. Cape Verde is in Spain's group, so they've got their work cut out for them for sure. And Curaçao, or if you're Wayne Gretzky at the draw, Caraco, one of many cringe elements from the draw yesterday. Curaçao is one of the least populous countries to ever qualify. Their coach noted, though, I should say this, Ader, they're a team of fighters. They're going to need that fighting spirit.
So sticking with soccer, the MLS Cup final is later today. Inter Miami face the Vancouver Whitecaps. Miami's captain, you mentioned him, Lionel Messi, the Argentine, is perhaps the greatest player ever. This is his third season in the MLS, but his first shot at the title. How do you see this matchup?
Yeah, this is exactly what Major League Soccer was hoping for, a matchup involving Lionel Messi's Inter Miami against the Vancouver Whitecaps for the title. I should say that Miami has been an absolute offensive juggernaut. They've scored 98 goals this season. Now, the problem here is that the Whitecaps beat Miami 3-1 earlier this season. They're dangerous. They're hardworking. And, of course, they've got a German star, Thomas Mueller, themselves. Now, Mueller has said, guys, it's not about Messi against Mueller. It's Miami against the Whitecaps. But we're going to be looking at Messi and Mueller tonight. I'm going to lean in the fairy tale outcome here. I think Miami takes it. I think it's going to be high scoring. And it is going to be a little bit about a fairy tale with Lionel Messi potentially winning here at home in Fort Lauderdale, his first shot at the title. And this back to back with perhaps another World Cup win next year, that's fairy tale.
So I have to say, the image of a determined mosquito will stay with me for a long time. Sports reporter Michelle Steele, thank you for being with us.
You bet.
The San Francisco Bay Area lost a beloved resident earlier this week, Claude, an albino alligator that lived at the California Academy of Sciences. He died at the age of 30. Among the people who said their final goodbyes to an old friend is Bart Shepard, senior director of the Steinhardt Aquarium.
He'd lived with us for 17 years, really captivated tens of millions of people during that time.
Captivated millions because of his unique ghostly looks.
Claude was completely white. He was a full albino. He had pink eyes and just really was a remarkable looking creature.
Claude got his looks from a genetic mutation that made his skin lack melanin. He came to San Francisco from an alligator farm in Florida. Shepard says albino alligators are extremely rare and almost never survive in the wild. That's because the same thing that made Claude so stunning to look at would make him vulnerable in his native swamps.
I doubt you would ever see an albino alligator in the wild. The vast majority of them would die as a young hatchling because they're bright white and they would stand out and predators could get them quite quickly.
Claude also risked getting sunburned in the wild. Seriously, to get warm, alligators like to lounge in the sun. And well, for a white alligator, that could be painful. So instead, Claude relaxed at the Steinhardt Aquarium, where he became beloved by visitors from all over the world.
A lot of people didn't think he was real. It was really fascinating to me. And he's just, you know, sort of became an icon for us, a sort of mascot for us and really a cultural fixture in San Francisco for sure.
Claude was the subject of two children's books and featured regularly in the advertising promoting the aquarium in the city of San Francisco. But Shepard says Claude's greatest impact was the wonder he inspired in visitors, helping people marvel at the biodiversity all around them.
People just really connected with him. I think, it sparks this sort of innate curiosity about the natural world and whether you were a school kid visiting here on a field trip or whether you were an older person who had been coming here for, you know, decades.
Claude had just turned 30 in September. The museum and the city celebrated him for the entire month. There were scavenger hunts, art installations where students could display their portraits of Claude, and of course,
a special birthday cake that the animal care staff made out of fish and ice, and he swam over and chomped that a couple of times to, you know, the great delight of the hundreds of people that were crowded around the top of the habitat.
Claude died on Tuesday. He had extensive liver cancer. Here's to an afterlife full of fish and ice cakes. The new movie, The Secret Agent, follows a man named Armando in hiding in the Brazilian city of Recife in 1977. Armando, who uses the alias Marcelo, is on the run from men hired by an industrialist to kill him. It's the latest film from Brazilian director Kleber Mendoza Filho, who has made a string of politically pointed movies about his country. The Secret Agent stars Wagner Moura as Armando, and he won Best Actor at the Cannes Film Festival for his role. The actor is also known from Narcos and Civil War, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the Brazil of 1977 when the movie is set.
Brazil was under a very heavy dictatorship from 64 until 85. And 77 was the beginning of the opening, but not quite. I mean, the echoes of the dictatorship kept going. I was born in 76, and I still remember as a kid the atmosphere of what it was to live under a dictatorship.
So your character, Armando, he used to work at a university as a scientific researcher, but yet he still becomes a target. How does he become a target?
This is an interesting thing, because when we talk about the dictatorship, we always think of the military and brutal force and censorship and things like that. But what happens is they empower people in their worst. And we have seen this even in Brazil under Bolsonaro and in other countries, I think. And the first thing that far-right/authoritarian government tries to do in their book list is to go against universities, journalists, and artists. And this is sort of what happened in Brazil, of course, during the dictatorship, but also in Brazil under Bolsonaro from 2018 to 2022. And that was actually what put Kleber and I together, because we were both very vocal against that government, and we both suffered the consequences of that. I myself had directed a film called Marighella, which is a film that takes place during the dictatorship. And I got my film censored. So this film, The Secret Agent, is a film not about a guy who was trying to overthrow the government or anything like that. It's about someone who was just trying to stick with his values when everything around him was said the opposite.
It's a really subtle film. And what struck me as very real in your performance is how understated Armando's fear is. I mean, he's not fearless, but yet at the same time, he's not paralyzed by the terror, right? I wonder how you approached playing someone under a death threat.
That's a very good question, because usually what I try to do is I try to put myself in the situation of the character. I really bring myself, Wagner, to the situations. And I usually react to injustice in a very explosive way. And in this case, I couldn't do that, because Armando he's trying to hide. He has to protect his son. He cannot call attention to himself. Everything had to happen very internally. And like I said, the genesis of this film was Kleber and I shared perplexity on what was going on in Brazil. So it's a little bit of myself, but it's a lot of Kleber too. And his temperature is a little lower. So I think this character is a mix of Kleber and I, and the circumstances where the character finds himself in are very tricky, right? He has to be more quiet. He cannot call attention to himself.
I think another thing that seems odd but real about this film is that the violence is actually in the background. People, mm-hmm. you know, they move around dead bodies. And even under a death threat, Armando manages to live. He manages to dance, right? And it's certainly mm-hmm. my experience when I go to really violent places. Is that your experience?
Yes, you know, when I did Narcos, and I was living in Colombia, in Bogota, and remember that Bogota back in the 80s was probably the most dangerous city in the world. And I was talking to my friends that lived there, and they were like, Wagner, we were living our lives. We were going to bars. We were, you know, and I think that's what happens in war zones as well. People try to carry on with their lives. that gives the character more complexity, right? Like when we are in very hard and tough situations, it's not that we are closed in a shell. I like characters that want to live.
So this film is set at the tail end of the Brazilian dictatorship. You've made a movie in 2019 about a resistance leader against that dictatorship. Last year, the movie I'm Still Here won an Oscar, and it was about the Brazilian dictatorship. Why do you think these stories are resonating now?
I think we have to keep talking about that. You know, it's a very recent scar in all Latin America, South American especially. Brazil, Argentina, Chile, you know, like Uruguay, we all had very strong and horrible dictatorships. And I know young people in Brazil, they go, oh my God, I wasn't aware of that. So was there a dictatorship here? So I think that what we do, not only artists, I mean, it's not our main job, but it's important to bring back facts. And Brazilian cinema always had this quality of trying to understand the country. That's why there are so many documentaries coming out of Brazil.
I don't want to give anything away, but there's a really important scene in Armando's life, in your character's life, that we don't see. It's only seen in a newspaper article. A researcher is looking at it in the present. What does that show us about how little we know about political dissidents?
I like that scene very much. I think that that scene is in tune with the rest of the film. You know, like Kleber doesn't give answers to many questions. So I feel that the fact that we don't show what happened to him is in tune with the rest of the film. But also, too, I don't know if you remember, but we see that in a newspaper and the headlines are corrupt teacher, corrupt professor gets killed. And that's another way of killing him. So he got killed and then they killed his memory. He was killed twice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and I think in the end, we don't actually get much answers, which is often the case in real life.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't get answers, but I don't feel that it's sad, but I feel a glimpse of hope in the end with that girl, that the researcher. I think that's a very important character because she's young and she's concerned about the truth. And what she offers to Armando's son is a pen drive with information. What she puts on that table is memory. She goes like, this is what I know about your father. But I love the fact that there is a younger person in that country that's concerned, and it's also offering him memory.
Wagner Moura stars in the new movie The Secret Agent in theaters now. Wagner, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Ader Peralta.
Coming up on the program in the next hour, the latest on the vaccine controversy involving the Centers for Disease Control. Also, a look at the Weekend Politics with NPR's Ryan Elving and Ader Peralta, Weekend Edition on KQED from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And support comes, of course, from you, the listener, sustaining member of KQED News. Michael State, good morning. It's 8:58 with traffic beginning in Mountain View. Here is Laurie Sanders. Laurie? Well, we have some type of technical problem. Don't have her at this hour. We'll get to her in the next hour. Now, support for KQED comes from Netflix. presenting Left-Handed Girl, Taiwan's official submission for international feature at the Academy Awards. A fresh beginning in Taipei comes with Generations of Secrets, now on Netflix, awards eligible. Support comes from the International School of San Francisco, a bilingual multicultural community where students PK2 through grade 12 learn to navigate the world with confidence, empathy, and joy. More at internationalsf.org. Lori, are you there now? Good morning. No deal. Here's what's coming up on the Monday morning edition of Morning Edition on KQED.
The Supreme Court hears oral arguments on a case that could expand the president's power and erode the power of some regulatory agencies. That's Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's on from 2 to 9 in the morning, and we'll have, of course, the latest KQED news on that morning for you as well. Now 9 o'clock, weekend edition time on KQED.